If my art has nothing to do with people's pain and sorrow, what is art for? Those words, spoken by Chinese artist and activist Ai Weiwei, described as one of the definitive cultural voices of the 21st century, his works span a spectrum of materials and ideas. Newsmakers visits Frederick Meyer Gardens and Sculpture Park, discovering Ai Weiwei, natural state.
So you have wallpaper, you have things made out of Legos, you got things that look like watermelons, you have ancient vases and so on and so forth. You know, it's not necessarily about the end product. And I think that that's very important. What it is about is the initial step forward, and that's where the concept is born. So that he realizes that the artist lives and can communicate through an idea. Now, whether he executes this through computer graphics or whether he uses some other porcelain artist to do this, or he uses a team to make little crabs or little white flowers or whatever the situation is, that sort of becomes secondary, but the idea is his, the concept is his. This is sort of a reversal of the way that many people think about art, because you think about, say, Monet, or any of the Impressionists, or Picasso, and so on and so forth, and they think about that art, it's about the brush strokes, and it's about the intensity and the individuality of the experience. You know, his is almost sort of the opposite of that. He doesn't need to apply every brush stroke. He can do it, but he doesn't necessarily need to do it. And for him, what I want to say about people, about the past, about present, about unity, about freedom of speech, about freedom of expression, that ultimately is more important to him than a pretty sunset or, you know, stacks of hay or whatever the situation would be for a Monet reference.
Hello, this is Ai Weiwei. I'm very happy to have a chance to talk to you, and my work is going to show in Meyer Garden, and this is a great opportunity for me to show my work here, and my iron tree already being installed in your beautiful landscape. I hope you enjoy the show and have a good time. Thank you.
You've met Ai Weiwei. What were the circumstances and what were the two of you discussing?
You know, I went to Beijing, I think, four times, and then to Berlin a few times, and then in between other locations where he was meeting. And the first piece of it, the part in Beijing, was perhaps the most interesting because the exhibition was really born in a moment when he was still under house arrest. And literally the cameras that you see in the wallpaper and in other parts of the display, there were 16 of them that were trained on his studio. And so it was a very odd experience, but it was a very fruitful experience. And we originally went there to talk to him about Iron Tree, which we acquired for our 20th anniversary and is now in the sculpture park. And I think Weiwei was very impressed in a good way. That we were making so much of an effort to come to him, knowing that he couldn't go elsewhere. And we really sort of developed a friendship. And the exhibition was sort of born out of those early meetings, but it was also born of the fact that he's interested in displaying in rather non-traditional circumstances. Now, of course, we've got the galleries and things like that, which are much more museum-like, for lack of better words. But he'd never done anything in a botanic garden. He'd never done anything in a conservatory, a greenhouse. And so I think for him, it was an opportunity to display in different circumstances, but also to look at his work through a new set of eyes.
Is that what makes him unique? That everything is different, everything is a new challenge, there's a new perspective. Many consider him a conceptual artist.
Yes, he's very much a conceptual artist, and that's why the work is so diverse, you know, that we could talk about Legos as artwork, we could talk about wallpaper as artwork, we could talk about ancient urns that have been painted or even broken as artwork. You know, he definitely fits the bill for a conceptual artist. You know, he takes on every project on its own terms, I guess I would call it. So, you know, what he did for us may have some passing similarities to other projects that he's done, but I can assure you that in some ways it's also very different than what he just did at the Hirshhorn or what he's just opened at the museum in Israel. So everything has its own independence, but it all comes out of the same family, I would say.
To understand him, you mentioned family. You really have to go back to his upbringing.
Sure.
And the culture from which he comes from, and the decades, the dynasties of traditional Chinese art.
Yeah. You know, he has a very interesting relationship with China. And I think that like a lot of Chinese cultural figures of the 20th, 21st century, it's a very troubled relationship. And that there are so many things about the history, the past, the people that are loved, that are embraced, but there are a lot of difficulties in terms of freedom of speech, freedom of expression, which are so important to him, that are bothersome because they don't exist or they don't exist fully. So you mentioned his background. His father was I Ching, who in the 20th century was perhaps China's most well-known and celebrated poet. You know, he'd be to us in America maybe the equivalent of Frost in the 20th century. Very well known, but also very revered. The father was then, and the mother, called out, and were called out as enemies of the state. And the family was basically sent into exile in a work camp or a re-education camp. So you go from this very famous poet, you know, poetry's very ephemeral, it's very lofty to begin with, and the fact that his job was basically cleaning toilets. And the family lived in these circumstances for 19 years. They moved a couple of times, one time really on the edge of the Gobi Desert. So he really saw life from interesting circumstances, shall we say. What you have to go through if you really want to follow through with your word and your beliefs. But I think as a part of that also, he never was discouraged from being an artist or thinking creatively, nor was he ever discouraged from thinking about China's past, immediate past, but also ancient past. So you're 100% right. His past did form him as the artist that we know and appreciate today.
Is there a distinct line from traditional Chinese art to Ai Weiwei?
Yeah, I think, you know, what's interesting is that when I was in graduate school, or even in a little bit earlier than that as an undergraduate, and we talked about Chinese art, we talked about, you know, historic temples, and we talked about ancient urns and scroll paintings and so on and so forth. And then there was this sort of great divide. And the fact that today, in the early 21st century, China, Beijing, Shanghai are two of the most important places for contemporary art, you know, somehow or another they vaulted through time and place to go from the tradition to become so very contemporary. Now what's sandwiched in the middle is a kind of Soviet communist style representational art that marked a lot of the 20th century, but really there's this huge past, and then there's this very, very vibrant, rich period of today. But the interesting thing is that Weiwei's probably more well known outside of China than he is known in China.
It's interesting when we talk about that arc of art in China, and behind us, there is something so startling about the sequence of photos of Ai Weiwei holding what I presume to be a Ming vase. Mm-hmm. And he lets it go and it smashes on the ground.
Yeah, it's a Han Dynasty urn, so it's more than 1,000 years old. And basically Weiwei had the opportunity when there was this thaw in the late 70s to come to the United States, and he spent 14 years primarily in New York. And when his father was very ill and near death, he decided it was time to go back. And when he went back, he was very surprised at how much had changed and how much hadn't changed. And one of the things that really bothered him is how much of China's past was obliterated. You know, Mao did away with hundreds of thousands of temples and scrolls and furniture and decorative pieces and so on and so forth, because the mentality was, we're just moving forward. The past is holding us down, we're just moving forward. So history, legacy, tradition was basically broken. And so in doing this, Weiwei was picking up things in thrift stores and roadside places. He picks up this old urn. And you have very accurately, I think, stated what a lot of us felt, this sort of shock that, geez, he's dropping the urn and he's letting it smash. But he was doing it with a purpose in mind. He's saying, okay, this is one urn. It's ancient, but it's not, you know, highly decorative. It was utilitarian, so on and so forth. And, you know, you're making all of this fuss about my dropping one urn, but what about the hundreds and thousands of other things that were completely and totally lost? So it's this sacrifice, certainly, and, you know, the kind of traditional art historian in me feels for that sacrifice, but the more contemporary art historian in me understands the kind of statement that he was making. But there's a similar sort of thing happening even with the urns, the vases that are behind us that are dipped in automotive paint. You know, the history is still in there, but he's transformed it in these very commercial, very modern, sort of almost macho colors that we associate with you know, BMWs and Mercedes as prize objects.
Is he more activist than artist, or artist than activist?
Yeah, chicken or egg.
Yeah, exactly.
I think that it's impossible to take away the two from the conversation. You know, he is very talented as a draftsperson. Some of the early drawings that I saw really blew me away, you know, just so focused on detail. He's an extraordinary designer. He has a really profound understanding of space. You know, we know from the Bird's Nest, he's really important in terms of architecture and so on and so forth. So that part of him as an artist is there. But sort of what set him apart and what was the match that was lit was this realization that art could be a very effective tool to be an activist. And if nothing else, I think that probably if we look back to 2008 and the Sichuan earthquake and how motivated he was by the fact that nobody was taking responsibility, that thousands and thousands and thousands of lives were lost, that somebody really needed to step up or somebody needed to really point the finger and say, you are responsible, that really galvanized his spirit to be an activist. That was really a crucial point. I think it was probably simmering when he was working on the Bird's Nest because he was so disappointed. It was a great project to do this project for the Olympics, but he saw that, you know, hundreds and hundreds of people were being displaced for the Olympic Village, and the prices for the Olympic events were becoming so costly, there was no way that an average Chinese man or woman, worker, laborer could afford to attend something. Yet it was all that everybody was talking about, and it was all that everybody was focused on. Eventually got to the point that he had to sort of disavow his association with the project.
So he, like his father and his mother today, he is an enemy of the state.
He is not seen in such warm terms. You know, he was arrested. You know, he was hauled away for 81 days. He still does not talk much about it. He's done some projects that narrate highlights. We don't know where he was. It was a very profound and upsetting experience, I think. And then he went through 4 years where he couldn't travel. And, you know, he had earlier chapters where when he was embracing new media and he was on Twitter and so on and so forth, you know, he was encouraged initially and then it was all taken away. And then his name, his reputation, his works were completely banned from the internet in China. So he became almost a kind of non-person. And I've never asked him this, but I oftentimes thought about, is it better to have gone through the difficult periods that were actual and physical, or was it worse to have been the sort of non-person because you were so active and so vibrant? I don't know how he'd answer that question, but it's one that I have to ask him sometime if I remember.
Ai Weiwei comes to New York in the 1980s, early 1980s?
Late 1970s. He was there for most of the 80s. Mm-hmm.
How would you describe him as an artist then? Yeah.
Well, I think that number one, he was blown away about what the art world was and what America was. And he had a very traditional concept of what art was. It was much more representational. It came out of that whole sort of Soviet communist style of hyper-realism, you know, people charging forward, and you know, everything had to look like something. And then he gets to, you know, the United States, and he's seeing conceptual art, he's seeing performance art, and it was like, well, what is this stuff? And, you know, how do I make sense of this? And so on and so forth. And so he was really, I think, during the New York period, in a kind of very intense sort of hothouse incubation. You know, he was doing sketches, he was drawing, and so on and so forth, and he began to do his first conceptual pieces then. The other thing that really blew him away is that he just couldn't believe how open the United States was, that, you know, people could protest. Yeah, they could walk down the street, and then there were signs, and there were assemblies, and, you know, so on and so forth. You know, there's this, he took a lot of photographs during this period, made some little films during this period. He in these photographs, was working as an artist, but it was also his lens to understand what American culture was. You know, there's this one image that I remember very clearly. It was during Bill Clinton's campaign, and, you know, Clinton's right there. You know, the windows rolled down of the Cadillac, and he's pressing the flesh with everybody. And that was just unimaginable for somebody like Wei Wei. So the American experience for him was about art, but it was also about the freedoms, and he understood just how vibrant and important and precious those experiences could be, especially in light of what his past was.
What is his breakthrough or his groundbreaking work that puts, that sets him apart from everyone else?
I think the thing that put him apart from everybody else and what put him in the history books was the piece that you were commenting on, the dropping of the Han Dynasty urn. Because in there, people realized that through a very simple gesture, he was really breaking down a lot of preconceived notions about what was happening in China, what a contemporary artist from China could be about, and that a Chinese artist today at some level did have to deal with their past. And I think that that was really one of the most powerful pieces. I think that some of the other early pieces that really got to people were the bicycle pieces, because the bicycle was such a symbol of transportation in China, is still today, but nothing like it once was. You know, just these seas of people on bicycle, and then taking them and creating elaborate structures and mazes out of them. But the other part of it was, you know, what was his online presence? You know, he was very much about Twitter, and he was very much about social media and communicating with people. And I think in an age before we were really talking about blogs and how people were communicating and so on and so forth, he got it. You know, he realized this was a really effective way to communicate. So I'd say those would probably be the breakthrough projects for him in the 90s.
There's the 1970s, 1980s Wei Wei, and then there is this new technology, social media Wei Wei. Is the art and the concept different in both places and time?
I guess that I would say that the earlier artist, when he was still drawing, when he was still taking all those photographs, was operating more as an observer. And although his powers of observation certainly have never diminished, and he's very keen and very insightful, I think if there was a second phase, I'd say it was when he left behind just recording his observations, and he began participating with society and engaging with society in a more powerful, a more forthright way. Did he know when he was in his 20s or late teens that this is the projection? Probably not. But he had to probably go through this intense period of observation before he became this artist that we think about today. And in my imagination, I sort of compare him to someone who goes through a very intensive training experience. Think about a doctor. You know, they go through all these different levels and intern, blah, 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 and then that. And then at some point in time, they go from that student phase, and they go from that generalist phase, and they activate as a professional in a very specific, decided way, and then it's their game, you know? Maturation, incubation, and then they're on. And I see that first part of Wei Wei's career that you referenced as more of the incubation period. As I said, it's also that time when he's just learning, and he doesn't run out of the gates fully yet. This is running out of the gates fully.
Who do you compare him to? What other artists do you
Today?
Yeah.
Well, I think if I were to think of a historical figure, I'd probably think about him most closely in connection with somebody like Marcel Duchamp, who was, you know, the great Dadaist and really opened up Pandora's box for what art could be earlier in the 20th century. I think that there are a lot of people that are trying and dealing with history. I think there are a lot of people that are trying and dealing with different types of media and materials. But I don't think that anybody is quite the polymath as Wei Wei is. And that's probably why he is in such demand and why he tries to fulfill that demand as best he can in terms of the exhibitions that he does all over the globe. You know, he's almost in his own category. And I don't really see another artist putting themselves on the line in quite the same way as he has for causes that he believes in. Certainly there are lots of activists, but you know, that artist-activist piece that you asked about earlier on, there are circumstances with him that are in a category of their own. And there are a lot of Chinese artists that deal with the past. You know, we have a wonderful artist in the collection, Zhang Huan. He does it in his own very poetic way. But it's quite different than what Wei Wei does. Watermelons are a metaphorical piece because, you know, you look at a watermelon from the outside and, you know, it's this beautiful sphere, very interesting, but then what you open up and find is very different, you know, because a watermelon is full of hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of seeds, and it's full of this flesh, and it's a very different experience on the inside than on the outside. It's somewhat similar to Iron Tree, but very, very similar to the way that we think about ourselves. Oftentimes we're very different on the outside than we are on the inside. You know, the interesting thing about this wallpaper is it reminds me of the phrase, you know, things aren't always as they seem. So you have people that come in here and the first impression is it looks like some very, you know, upscale scarf, you know, Gucci or Hermes or, you know, some elaborate object, because it is. It's gilded and it's decorative, and then you get up closer and like, holy moly, those are cameras, and oh my gosh, those are handcuffs, and oh my gosh, those are twisted pieces of steel. And you realize that all of these things are biographical, and that, you know, it's gold and it's fanciful and it's decorative and it has this relationship to consumer culture. But when you get into it, you realize this is some serious stuff. I mean, this is a guy that was arrested. This is a guy who was handcuffed. This is a guy who was followed. You know, I mentioned that, you know, when I went there the first time, I think there were 16 cameras that were trained on his studio. And you realize, there's something going on in here. And it's not what I thought it was the first time.
As you know, I have visited this exhibition before, and there is one piece that really captures my attention. I can stand there for 5, 10, 15 minutes just staring at this. It's all those white flowers, and the presentation is on the floor, where flowers normally are located on the ground, but you're looking down at this, and it just draws me in. What is it about that piece that captures everyone's attention?
Yeah, you know, I'm honored that you like that piece, because I think it's one of the masterpieces in this exhibition. And I'd say it's mesmerizing, and it's very much a transportational piece, because it can take you places. You know, the show is called Natural State, and I think with any really good work of art, you go through different states, sort of like a relationship, you know, you go through meet and greet, and maybe dating, and then, you know, maybe it gets serious and that, and you change, you know, and your relationship with that other person changes. So the same thing here, you know, you meet this thing, it's like, whoa. And maybe you're overwhelmed with the craftsmanship, you know, how do they do that, you know? Maybe you're taken at the next level with, I'm just losing myself in this sea of flowers. I'm losing myself in this bed of white, you know, it's pure, it's clean. And then perhaps the ultimate state is reading a little bit about this piece and realizing that it's very much about Wei Wei's father and about the Hundred Flowers Movement, which was this sort of opening very briefly in 1957, 1958, when Mao said he wanted to hear from the people, and many people did speak out. It's still argued whether he was being honest in that desire or whether it was a trap to sort of pull people out. And then, you know, the wall came down, so to speak, and those that spoke out were sent off, like Wei Wei's family was sent off. And you realize that the freedom of speech and that freedom of expression that those people during the Hundred Flowers Movement that went out, it's like a flower, you know? It's fragile. It's like a living thing. It's brief. It's transitory. It doesn't last for a long period of time. And so, you know, go in, appreciate the craftsmanship, lose yourself in the work. But I think that ultimately this idea of state is the state of enlightenment when you realize that these pieces come together, you know, artist, activist, they can come together, and I think in this work, perhaps more than any other way, in homage to his father, comes together in a very poetic way. And I think that a lot of people are stopped in their tracks with that piece in particular because they're lost in the visual poetry of it all. And you're not alone in how you were feeling, and it's a star. It's a star for the show.
As you get to sit with him while he's under house arrest,
yeah.
Did you get a chance to see the seeds and to see who he is as a person, just interacting with him?
We've spent a lot of time together, and you know, it's certainly been one of the great opportunities and joys of my career thus far, you know, we've really developed a very close relationship, and I think we'd each describe the other as a friend. And, you know, I've spent a lot of time with his family, a lot of times with his, taught his son to play tic-tac-toe, you know, to play the I Spy game, and let him just sort of relax. The thing that surprised me the most is just how soft-spoken he is. Now, you know, he can get angry and he can be vociferous, but by and large, he conducts himself in a very calm, very reserved, very sort of peaceful state. And that really took me by surprise because sometimes, you know, artists can be very brash. They have a lot of energy. They have their ideas and they're going to just clobber you over the head with it. Not all artists like that, but some are. So I was really surprised at just how, for lack of a better word, serene he was. He's a busy guy. Especially in the period since he had his passport back and was able to travel. You know, it was very interesting because those times in Beijing were actually in some ways more quiet and more personal and more one-on-one. And then the places that we've been together since, when he's been free, so to speak, it's just overwhelming, you know. Every museum director, museum curator in the world seems like they've come out of the woodwork because now it's safe and now it's okay, you know. I can go, I can meet him in Paris, I can go and meet him in London, I can go meet him in Berlin. It's a, you know, the stakes maybe aren't as high. I'm glad that I had that opportunity. And I think that it made this exhibition special. But I also think that it wasn't necessarily the logical move for him. I mean, the year before, he had an exhibition in Paris, he had an exhibition in London, he had an exhibition in Melbourne. You know, right now he's got an exhibition at the Smithsonian, he just opened one in Israel, you know, so on and so forth. You know, Grand Rapids doesn't quite fit into that in a logical way. But I think it was his commitment to us as we were committed to him early on, and not in the easiest period for him.
Transparency and friendships.
Yeah.
Joseph Becker, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.